today. As the political turmoil continues, the Conservatives hope that billions more for education could be an election winner. But can it make up for almost a decade of austerity? And we hear from the doctor who clashed with Jacob Rees-Mogg over the impact of a no-deal Brexit.
Tell Auntie Anoushka what's happening in September.
I'm going to...
Just don't eat the banana now. What is happening in September?
I'm going to go to school.
I'm looking forward to going back to school because this year we're doing science.
I'm looking forward to learning about the Amazon rainforest in year three.
It is going to be fun.
I'm looking forward to art, my new topics, maths, because I'm good.
I'm looking forward to learn. I'm doing some clubs and playing with my friends.
I'm just going to play with my friends.
On Friday, we have fish and chips.
What do you think you'll do at school?
Crafts and stuff.
My uniform is like a white shirt,
an optional black jumper.
I'm not going to wear a dress. I'm going to red trousers.
The point of school is to learn. And the point of learning is to give you a good education. And the point of having a good education is getting you a good work. And if you have a good work, all the places you'll go.
Children like these are starting school this week. It's an exciting time for them and their parents. But in September 2019, they are entering an education system that has faced many years of real terms funding cuts. It's so bad, some heads are turning to parents for financial help. Now Boris Johnson is promising more money for schools in preparation for a general election whenever it comes. According to a Guardian leak, the cash will come alongside controversial measures to crack down on bad behaviour. Will any of it make a difference? From The Guardian, I'm Anoushka Astana. Today in Focus, back to school after almost a decade of austerity.
I think primary schools are brilliant at kind of communicating with parents. I think they've always tried to build very strong relationships.
Sally Wheel is The Guardian's education correspondent.
I mean, the schools that I've been in, schools where my children have been taught, were encouraged to go into the classroom at the beginning of the day, so you meet other parents. You'll very often get involved in helping children to read, or you might get involved in sort of supporting teachers on school trips. So you're built into the fabric of the kind of class and the school. And I think parents get very passionate about their primary schools and feel, you know, they're very invested in them.
All of which is lovely. And, you know, being asked to read in school or provide support in that way is great. But that involvement is beginning to change, isn't it?
I think it is, quite dramatically. I think they need much, much more. PTAs, or Parent Teachers Associations, have always been in existence. Summer fetes and Christmas fairs and so on to help support a school trip or, you know, extra play equipment or something like that, but really just extras. But I think what's really changing is that parents are kind of being enlisted as really significant fundraisers.
And it's going beyond that, isn't it? People are being asked to start paying towards their schools.
Yeah. I mean, these are state schools, and yet we're hearing more and more of schools asking not just for one-off donations, but for regular donations. So, you know, our school's in trouble. Could you please set up a direct debit for us? It's a donation. It's not compulsory. £10 a month, £30 a month.
Do we know how common that is?
I think it's quite frighteningly common.
We're hearing from schools that are sending out essentially begging letters to parents, asking parents to set up direct debits to fill funding gaps.
One parent, Elizabeth, wrote to me to say she's received a letter from a daughter's school asking for a monthly donation to top up the reduced funds that her school is receiving.
So we would really encourage you to dig deep and donate for the school and your children.
2 years ago, it would have been a news story.
Now, more and more parents are being asked to make regular payments to help support their child's school.
But, you know, I read what you write. There's some pretty mad stuff going on in terms of the things that parents are being asked to do.
Yes, they're kind of being asked on all fronts, I think, now. And for things that you really wouldn't imagine that they'd have to supply. So incredibly basic stuff. Toilet rolls, paper, pens and pencils.
What, bring in loo roll?
That's, stories have been reported saying that, yeah. Schools have tried to become a bit more systematic with it. So they set up Amazon kind of wish lists. I mean, over the summer, we have seen head teachers posting on their school websites asking, are there any parents who could help out? The school needs fixing. I've got problems with maintenance. Any volunteers come and help?
What do you mean, problems with maintenance?
Roof falling down, windows not working. I think it's, they cannot afford this stuff now. So they're trying to use every means possible to at their disposal to get this stuff done so they can carry on functioning.
Presumably, if funding is so bad that that's going on, then the experience for children in schools is changing as well.
Yes, I think kids and their families definitely are noticing things like, say, if you've got two children or three children going through the same school, you may start to notice, oh, what's happened to that trip that my other child or my other two children went on? That trip doesn't happen anymore. Or we used to have school orchestra. What's happened to that? Kind of more fundamentally, I think they will notice staffing changing, things like teaching assistants. Since probably the early 2000s, that's been something that's been really pushed as a way of supporting children with special educational needs. They are going at an alarming rate.
And what about things like class sizes? I mean, it's the law, isn't it, that class sizes have to stop at 30?
That's right. But that's being breached more and more. Secondary schools, there's a bit more flexibility. But I've certainly heard teachers discussing about possibly kind of introducing lecture style lessons for large groups of students. All your money is spent on teachers' wages, so kind of that's where you'll make savings if you can, if, you know, as a last resort. There's another secret teacher series on television over the summer. They sent people into the classroom, and I think people were just really, really shocked to find an English teacher dealing with 60 kids in one class.
Oh, that was Channel 4.
That was a Channel 4 programme, yeah, The Secret Teacher.
Everyone listen.
How come we're in a big class like today?
Big class. Leon. I think it's like nearly 60 people in there.
60 is it? Oh, God.
One teacher, it's a bit mad.
Due to staff shortages, Head of English, Mr Harding, is teaching two classes at the same time.
When you introduce the speech, I'm just going to wait. Guys, sorry, it's too noisy. I can't really concentrate.
It's a lot of children to try to teach.
And then the other thing that I have to say doesn't happen at my kid's school, but I've heard about this from friends. And I know that Jess Phillips, the Labour MP, is extremely angry about this. Is this idea that schools are saying, pick your children up early on a Friday, you can do a half day.
In this country, we still expect the state to have a responsibility in the education of our children for 5 days a week.
She took her son to Downing Street and plonked him on the doorstep of number 10 to say, one sec, the state is supposed to be looking after my child right now.
Her son Danny was left to get on with some homework.
Danny, how do you feel about sitting on the steps of Downing Street?
I feel worried and excited at the same time. 5 days a
week. Campaigners estimate that about 200, 250 schools are either doing it or considering doing it.
It's the personal education cut.
When it started happening, you know, we used to write about it because it was such an extraordinary idea. But again, it is becoming a bit more common.
And one of the really interesting things that you're pointing out in all of this is that if schools are facing cuts and they're more dependent on parents, then schools that have parents who are more financially able are going to help their schools more than those who can't, which means we also end up getting increased inequality as a result of this.
It is building in a kind of deep injustice into the system, isn't it? A lot of energy has in the past gone into trying to close the disadvantage gap. So free school meals and pupil premium. What's happening now is that children from deprived backgrounds who are in schools in poor areas, there's kind of a double whammy. Those schools simply do not have the same means to raise funds. Whereas a school in a kind of wealthy area, they can raise tens of thousands of pounds. Progress has been made on closing the attainment gap. And that's stalled. And, I mean, you know, we don't know what's caused it, but there's been a long period of austerity and things are pretty tough in some schools.
You mentioned austerity. I mean, is that the cause of all of this?
There was a period in the 90s under the Tories when education funding was very low and it was very clear that schools were suffering at that time. And I think with Tony Blair, when he came in, do you remember his kind of rallying call of
education, education and education?
That was what he stood on, basically. And he got in, a lot of money went in and things did improve. 2008, there was the financial crash. We have a coalition government and austerity is brought in.
We have some deep and pressing problems, a huge deficit.
We are going to bring the years of ever-rising borrowing to an end.
And that is what we are seeing playing out in our schools today. They promised to ring-fence the funding for schools, which was a far better deal than other departments got. But what's happened since is that money stood still and costs have just escalated massively. It's not kept up pace with inflation.
They weren't ring-fencing it in real terms. They were ring-fencing it in cash terms.
Exactly. And there was a particular issue with post-16 funding, which has seen funding to sixth form colleges and FE colleges really, very, really hard hit.
The figure that I've heard quoted is that per pupil spending fell by 8% in real terms between the beginning of the coalition and 2017-18. Is that a trend that's continued this year?
Yes, funding this year will be at 2011-12 levels, and yet we all know that the costs have gone up dramatically.
Actually, the amount of money we're spending on schools is greater than it has ever been before. But we don't.
The Institute for Fiscal Studies, which is a very kind of sober, credible organisation, says it's the largest reduction in education spending for at least 30 or 40 years. A growing number of schools are in deficit. The government's mantra has been that it's putting more money into funding than ever before. That might be strictly true, but the costs have gone up so much that they outstrip the money that's going into the system.
And this has been a big political issue for the Tories. I remember the 2017 election campaign. People talk about Brexit, but afterwards, when I was speaking to Conservative MPs about why they felt they lost the majority, the number one thing they said came up on the doorstep was school cuts. Why was that?
It's true, the 2017 election kind of changed the landscape.
What we're actually being asked to make now are cuts. And in order to make our budgets balance, we're having to cut our provision to the point where it will cease to be a decent education.
I think it was largely, or in part, due to a website that the unions created.
Find out if your school is on the list at schoolcuts.org.uk.
It did an absolutely brilliant job of raising the alarm, and it brought teachers and parents together.
I am here to teach you all a lesson.
There was a kind of angry claim from some politicians that head teachers had become very politicised and that they were virtually advising parents to vote against the Conservatives, or at least they were spelling out the extent of the cuts very dramatically. Was that true? Did that happen?
Well, there were stories in the Daily Mail and other papers complaining. Yes, these are sort of, you know, lefty teachers brainwashing children and writing letters to parents. But I think in reality, heads were very careful. Their message was, you know, after silently lobbying for funding for a long time, they, you know, they're seeing their pupils suffering. They felt they had no alternative but highlight what's happening in their schools. So, I mean, I think we saw for the first time teachers and parents really joining forces. You'd see huge banners posted outside on the school gates saying, you know, what was happening in the school, you know, we've lost this much money, jobs at risk. Impossible for politicians to ignore. Polls were suggesting that it was as important as Brexit and the health service to voters. So, yes, it became a really big issue.
I'm only touching on this here, Sally, because I think we will do an entire separate episode on special needs funding. But just because it's so important, how has this affected SEN?
These are the most vulnerable children in society. So, I mean, parents are already dealing with those additional talent challenges. And it's actually become very apparent in the reporting of these stories that, you know, they have to fight every step of the way for everything they get. So it's become very high up the agenda. The problem is councils who have a high needs budget, which pays for this additional support, has been absolutely decimated during austerity. At the same time, costs have gone up. There are more children who are entitled to additional support, and councils just haven't got the budget for it.
Last week, Sally, you and other journalists here at The Guardian reported on a leaked briefing paper that outlined some big and also controversial proposals for schools from the government. We'll go into some of the details of what you saw, but since then, they have actually published the spending plans.
We've got an announcement to make.
What are they going to do?
We are putting a lot more money into schools, you'll be pleased to know.
The key proposal is a big cash injection, and they say that's over £14 billion by 2022-23. And when you look into that a bit more, it starts with an extra £2.6 billion in the first year, then an additional £2.2 billion the year after, and then £2.3 billion the year after that. So it adds up to £7.1 billion, but it's that cumulative counting.
OK, so it does sound pretty good.
Yeah, it's a lot of money. I mean, the head teachers and unions have given it a kind of cautious welcome.
Everyone's waiting to see where the money will actually go. Do we have any sense? I mean, where do we think it could fall?
So they've already said there's £700 million for SEND.
Special educational needs.
Yes, which is welcomed, but I think the feeling is that just isn't enough.
When you say not enough, put that in context for me.
For example, a council might have one single child with such high needs that it costs them £500,000 a year just for one child. There's an additional £400 million for post-16. And part of this package was an announcement that starting salaries are going to go up to £30,000 within 4 years.
The key thing is that the money goes not just to classrooms and to improving the schools, but above all to teachers as well, because I think teachers are absolutely crucial in all our lives. Teachers change lives, they certainly change...
That has been well received. Recruitment of new staff has been a real problem.
But you were telling me about pretty serious cuts in real-term spending over the past decade. Does this reverse that?
The Institute for Fiscal Studies says this should reverse the spending cuts since 2009-10, which takes spending back to those days. So that was 9 years ago. So, in terms of real terms, increased spending, they'd have to put more in. So this is just taking us back to those levels.
And do you think that that help from parents is going to be something they're going to have to keep asking for?
Certainly at the moment. I mean, I don't think there's any new funding next year.
Why don't they just put it in now?
I don't really know, to tell you the truth.
Because you've got to vote for them before you get the money. Maybe it's that.
Maybe it is that, yeah.
Sajid Javid, the Chancellor, is delivering the government spending review today. I think we can expect quite a few eye-catching, election-ready promises. Do we know where this money for schools is coming from?
Yeah, from the leaked document that we saw, the word reprioritised came up against lots of these spending pledges.
What does that mean?
I take from that that it means taking money from elsewhere in the budget.
So a suggestion that some of the money may not be new?
Exactly, may not be new.
And assuming they're not going to get away with reprioritising all the money, where else could they get money from? Is this going to mean an increase in borrowing?
We've had a period of austerity. The feeling is that austerity, they will be able to portray it as austerity coming to an end. And they may have built up some sort of room for manoeuvre, higher borrowing. But as I say, I've talked to head teachers about these new commitments and they've said, well, we'll wait and see what it looks like because you have these huge figures. And actually, you know, when it comes to seeing it actually in your school, it just doesn't look like that at all.
And the leaked document also had quite a lot of other details about policy. What did it say?
It was fascinating. One of the most interesting sections was on behaviour and toughening up discipline in schools. And that's long been a favourite with the Conservatives. One of the phrases that leapt out was backing teachers and head teachers and the use of reasonable force.
What does that mean?
Intervening in fights, keeping a child safe, keeping others safe from a child who might be behaving dangerously.
So maybe restraining a child.
Yes, I think so. That was combined with other sort of strands of this behaviour policy, which is about banning mobiles, backing teachers who choose to exclude children and all the complications that come with that, and a whole sort of revised guidance on behaviour and discipline in schools.
All these changes in behaviour are fascinating, and there's a huge debate about whether they work or not. I think we should do another episode on that.
I think that'd be really interesting.
You mentioned a few times that this might be about an election, an imminent election from the sound of it. I mean, we know how badly it played in 2017. Do you believe that they see education as a vote winner?
Yes. I mean, they've clearly had a big problem with education, and this is their way of addressing that and win those voters back, some, you know, many of whom did go to Labour.
Everyone thinks they're an expert in education because they either went to school or they have children who are in school. And I've always thought over the years, I've covered quite a lot of education secretaries. I did used to cover education years ago. They always talk about their own anecdotal experiences and they try and bring that to what they're going to tell the country it needs to do, which is a bit worrying when you consider Boris Johnson's cabinet. I mean, he was educated at Eton, and nearly two in three members of his cabinet went to private school.
Well, good morning, everybody, and it is wonderful to see this new team assembled here, respecting, I think, the...
Do you think that has the potential to affect how they go about trying to fix some of the problems facing the state education system?
Well, they'd obviously say not, but... In recent years, I think we've seen a kind of change taking place with different kinds of MPs coming into the House of Commons. You know, a greater representation of people from state school backgrounds, you know, sort of diversity, ethnic diversity, more women. We've seen in the cabinet, I think that had been changing, hadn't it?
Yeah, it's really interesting, actually. If you look at what Theresa May did, she was disappointing in terms of increasing the number of women.
Yeah.
But she definitely improved the school mix.
Exactly. So it does feel like it's a backward step. People say that governments, they do make policy based on their own kind of experience.
Well, I'm certainly not part of the aristocracy. That's definitely true.
So we settle for upper middle?
I'm a man of the people.
Let's head back to Downing Street. There is Gavin Williamson, of course, who is now the Education Secretary. He's back in.
To be fair, the new Education Secretary, Gavin Williamson, he's different. He was state educated. His wife used to be a primary teacher, so he's got a certain kind of insight into what's going on into schools on a personal level.
Commitment, not just for 1 year, but over 3 years to increase spending. This is something that so many people have already welcomed. The teaching unions have seen this as a real boost.
Well, we think about, see it as compensating to a certain extent for the cuts.
We've just heard this funding announcement, promises about 16 to 18 education. He's definitely got an interest in skills and further education rather than just universities. So it's going to be interesting to see how it pans out.
Well, along the way, we've already talked about two other episodes we can make as a result of this chat. And there's a third one. Sally, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was our education correspondent, Sally Wheel. Do follow all her reporting on the website. Coming up, the no-deal Brexit clash between a consultant neurologist and the Tory leader of the House of Commons, Jacob Rees-Mogg. Now, Dr. David Nicol worked on the government's alarming Operation Yellowhammer plans for a no-deal Brexit before becoming a whistleblower. On Monday, he challenged the Brexiteer Tory leader of the House, Jacob Rees-Mogg, during a live LBC phone-in over the reality facing patients in the outcome that Britain crashes out of the EU without an agreement.
I was contacted by LBC because there was a report coming up from the British Medical Association about the quote-unquote catastrophic effects of no-deal Brexit, and I was due to do the interview at 9:15, and then I got a phone call about 5 minutes before saying, I'm really sorry, we're going to have to bump you because Jacob Rees-Mogg's come on. I said, well, you know, why don't I ask him a question?
I was actually involved in Yellowhammer and drafting the plans of mitigation for a no-deal Brexit in March. And my question to you really is, what level of mortality rate are you willing to accept in the light of a no-deal Brexit?
Well, I don't think that there's any reason to suppose that a no-deal Brexit should lead to a mortality rate. I think this is the worst excess of project fear, and I'm surprised that a doctor in your position would be fear-mongering in this way on public radio.
This is the only question to ask any MP that supports a no-deal Brexit, and that severely rattled him. Good. Well, I mean, his response was actually the same as I've had from every Brexiteer for the last 4 months, and it always followed the same line, oh, that's Project Fear, that's fake news. And then you tell them, well, actually, I was one of those little minions that was responsible for writing some of the mitigation, so I do know what I'm talking about. And he's not the one that's going to have to face someone potentially in the courts and have to face the medical legal consequences if I get it wrong. You know, he can go and get lost, frankly. Having dealt with these, confidential files, you know, seeing patients in clinic who were on some of these drugs where I knew there were stockpiling issues, where there were supply issues and we hadn't actually left yet, what does one do or say, basically? So actually it becomes an ethical dilemma about what you do in that situation. And I felt uncomfortable that the plans weren't safe, and I spoke to the Commons Health Select Committee, I spoke to the GMC, I spoke to my Medical Defence Organisation, I spoke to my trust. Ironically, I was actually speaking at a whistleblowing conference at the Royal Society of Medicine, and there's a slide of me saying I'm not a whistleblower, and ended up being a whistleblower myself, basically. The wide-scale areas in which patients are at risk of coming to harm and will come to harm in the event of a no-deal Brexit, I am absolutely in no doubt in my mind that some patients will die. No one can say the answer to that. It may be a very small number or it may be a very big number. But someone within Whitehall will have planned for this. And when Yellowhammer came out and Michael Gove said this is worst case scenario, I knew immediately that was false. And the reason I knew it was false is when you had other government ministers, specifically Stephen Hammond, who was a junior health minister in February, wrote to a fellow Tory MP and explained that, wait for this, okay, that they were stockpiling body bags for an expected increased death rate in the event of a no-deal Brexit. Just staggering. Okay, now that is not part of Yellowhammer. That'll be part of the contingency planning for more worst-case scenarios. I believe I've actually started Operation Canary rather than Operation Yellowhammer. I'm going to keep singing like a canary until we get this resolved, because I think it's fundamentally my job as a doctor to raise issues of patient concern, and I'm going to keep banging on about it because I think it is unacceptable that a political class can be so negligent of medical care that they are quite prepared for patients to be harmed. For Jacob Rees-Mogg, no-deal Brexit has become an article of faith, almost literally a religious faith, which you have to believe in at all costs, no matter what the consequences are. And that's mad.
That was David Nicol. My thanks to him and to Sally Wheel and to the lovely children, including my own, who contributed to the piece. Good luck to everyone who is starting or returning to school this week. Thank you also for all your reviews. Do keep them coming. Today's episode was produced by Chika Ayres, India Rackerson and Gary Marshall. Sound design was by Axel Cocoutier. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. We'll be back tomorrow.